Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Great to have you with us today. Time now for our play-by-play call of the day. A monster shot by Giancarlo Stanton.
Leak, the 29-year-old. From a high set, delivers, and Stanton swings and puts a charge into another one. This is driven hard and deep out into left center. It is up, up and away, a home run for Giancarlo, a three-run homer. He's hit home runs in each of his first two at-bats, and the Marlins now have a 6-0 lead in the second.
Call last night on WINZ, the Marlins Radio Network, and Miami beat St. Louis last night 9-6. Great to have you with us on the show today. Phillies and the Pirates, 6:05 this evening. It'll be a 5:30 airtime as the Phillies go for a split of this four-game set. Pirates won last night as Gerrit Cole got the job on the mound. And then also at the plate, Cole delivered a couple of RBIs in last night's game. How about John Gray, the pitcher for the Colorado Rockies last night? Gray hit... Now, this is the pitcher. Hit a 467-foot home run last night. 467. That was Aaron Judge-like, except he's the pitcher. That's amazing. 467-foot home run from a pitcher in last night's game. At Coors Field, no less. Obviously, that ball did not spend as much time in the humidor as they were hoping for. And we'll try and connect with Richard Sandomir in a few moments, and we'll talk about Pride of the Yankees, the legendary movie in which he did incredible, meticulous research. And he's with us now. Richard, thank you so very much for your time. Appreciate it. Your book is an absolutely fascinating read.
Thank you very much. It's good to hear.
Well, let's start with this. First of all, the concept of it. What brought you to write about this movie and do it at this particular moment in time?
Well, it almost didn't happen at this moment in time. I had been noodling around with the idea for a while, inspired by first the resonance of Gehrig's original speech, and then getting more focused on Cooper's version. And then if you get into the Cooper version, then you start getting into the whole movie. So I had a couple of versions of a proposal that didn't work out, and finally with a new agent in 2015, we fixed it up and we sold it. So, but you could say I'd gotten obsessed with the movie.
Cooper's version, of course, is the one that Hollywood puts out there. You had to do a lot of research because the papers were a little bit all over the place as to what the version was, but the luckiest man in the face of the earth is not the last line. It actually is almost at the beginning of the speech, correct?
Correct. It's the second line of the speech, but you know, even that is not an absolute certainty, because if you look at what's left of the original newsreel of Gary delivering the speech, he goes up there without anything in hand. So he's either ad-libbing it, speaking from notes, or speaking from memory of notes or conversation he had with Eleanor or anybody else who contributed. The version that we view as the official version of the speech was something that Eleanor gave to Samuel Goldwyn when she was insisting that the movie speech be the same as the original that Lou gave. And she said, "I am giving this to you from memory." Her memory was had to be somewhat off, because what she offered up was different in certain ways from the newspaper accounts. Nobody was prepared to do a transcript because nobody was prepared for him to make a speech. So we do know that the luckiest man line, and you know, you've heard about a bad break, and that stuff comes directly from the newsreel. But it's hard to tell what truly was the actual original version.
Movies can take artistic license. I'll give you an example of a sports movie that does, The Greatest Game Ever Played, with Shia LaBeouf, about Francis Ouimet. And it shows Ouimet on the 18th hole of the playoff with Ted Ray and Harry Vardon, and handshaking, he knocks in the par putt to win. In reality, he won the playoff by 5 shots. What artistic license is taken in this movie based on your meticulous research?
Well, you know, Eleanor was reading the various scripts as they were being written, and she would send letters to Goldwyn, or to Goldwyn through her agent, Christy Walsh, and she would say, "Well, you know, you can portray our wedding the way you want, but Lou's parents weren't there; they were there in the movie." She said, you can't have Miller Huggins, the Yankee manager, sign Lou to a contract wearing a suit in the Yankee office. That would have been Ed Barrow. Well, that's the way it was in the movie. She sort of won a battle where she said, well, you can't have Lou hit 400 runs in a World Series game. Well, that was changed, if not directly, indirectly, to the scene where Lou promises to hit 200 runs in a World Series game for the paralyzed the kid with polio, right, in the hospital. So she's, and I have about 4 or 5 letters that each contain 8 to 10 things where she was in part showing off her baseball knowledge. What's true about the movie is that she was a baseball fan, and she certainly learned more from Lou. And she would try to say, listen, we have to make this as credible as possible, because there'll be all sorts of press people out there critical of whenever we make a big whopper. Because, you know, back then, 1942, 41, when she was started writing these letters, the sports film genre barely existed. So people weren't prepared for anything like this. So if the New York sports writers saw all these errors, they were going to pounce. I think only one pounced a little bit. But I think she helped steer them away from big mistakes.
And in the end, I guess she was pleased with the outcome, including the portrayal of Teresa Wright, and she wasn't sure about Teresa Wright originally playing her, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, put it this way. Teresa Wright was about 18 years younger than Gary Cooper. She had only done two other movies. Of course, in all three of her first movies, she was nominated for Academy Award and won one of them. I think she had to grow accustomed to Teresa Wright doing it, because I think she favored someone like Barbara Stanwyck, who'd been with Cooper and Meet John Doe. But I think when you see Teresa Wright's work, you see someone who acts maturely beyond her years, who clearly made a very credible helpmate to Cooper as Eleanor, and a very supportive, a little bit of a teasing relationship. But, you know, Cooper, who could make an emotion in his heart clear with just the flick of an eye, sometimes had these wonderful broad smiles when Teresa Wright was in his presence. It was acting. I'm sure he liked her, but, you know, it was clear that they naturally, and from direction and the script, clearly showed that they were a terrific couple. And I think what Eleanor liked about that was, yes, this was going to help perpetuate Lou's image as a great husband. She also enjoyed a very different portrayal of her by Blythe Danner 35 years later, in a movie that was based on Eleanor's own memoir, and Eleanor counseled Blythe to not be as sweet a character as Teresa played her, but I'm a tough cookie, play me more like a tough cookie.
Gary Cooper, of course, he was under contract to Sam Goldwyn, so despite what they wanted to put out as to who would play Gary, he was going to be the choice. He's right-handed, Lou Gehrig's left-handed. What did it take for him to play the part?
Well, he undertook 6 weeks of lessons from the former National League batting champion Lefty O'Doul. Got some other help from Bill Dickey, and you know, there's been a legend that's grown up around the movie that Cooper failed at becoming a lefty, so they filmed all the scenes right-handed and flipped the film. Well, you know, the best available person to analyze this, a curator at the Hall of Fame who looked at this film frame by frame and who's an expert in the way buttons are put onto uniforms, expert on you know, the labels on bats. He said they, in order to do the flipping, it's more than just, you know, having Cooper bat right-handed and run to third base instead of first base and then have it flipped. It means everybody, the front of everybody's uniform has to have the letters backwards, the numbers have to be backwards. Everybody, not just Cooper. So, he felt that in only one instance, in the minor league montage of scenes where Lou is in Hartford, it's very clear that the Cooper could not learn to throw left-handed, which may be the hardest task of all. And so that was flipped. But, you know, I happen to think that, you know, here's a guy, 40 years old, never played baseball before. I think he did okay. I think, you know, the swing is not Gehrig, but in 1942 there wasn't that great a demand that our actors be great athletes. Nowadays, someone with Cooper's lack of baseball skills would never be cast. We've seen Kevin Costner, we've seen Robert Redford, we've seen Chadwick Boseman in 42. Right. We've seen all these athletic actors. You can't have someone like that, and now they're making a movie about Lou Gehrig based on the biography by Jonathan Eich. So it'll be interesting to see the athletic skills of the actor they choose to play Lou.
Sam Goldwyn, though, is not a baseball fan. I think it's safe to say, based on reading this book, he was not a baseball fan. He'd rather see the romantic angle played up. So, in the end, was Goldwyn pleased with the balance that he wanted to see between baseball, which is, of course, part of the heart and soul of Gehrig, and also the romantic part that he thought was essential to a movie?
Well, look, he got 11 Academy Award nominations. It was his best. It grossed more than any other film that he had up to that point. So, yeah, I have to say he was pleased by that. You know, there are incidents even early on where he was fed up with what he saw in his script, and he said, "I'm going to cut Babe Ruth's part in half. I'm going to not even hire any of these Yankee ball players." He was very temperamental, but I think he had to be pleased by the reception. The reviews were, I'd say, 85% positive. There was a little bit of criticism that, you know, there isn't much drama in there. Well, what they were talking about was traditional sports drama. There was no bottom of the ninth home run. There was no great catch. The biggest drama on the field was whether Gehrig would hit that second home run for the kid with polio. And that's the way it was supposed to be. The climax was the speech. And there aren't many sports movies with a better climax than that.
No, I agreed. Eleanor Gehrig, though, was either at the soundstage or an extra when he delivered the speech, right? And her emotions came through?
Yeah. You know, movie magic such as it was in 1942, you're led to believe that Cooper delivered the speech on field, and they were using Wrigley Field in Los Angeles, the other Wrigley Field, as their as the location for the baseball action. But for the 2 or 3 minutes where Cooper is delivering the speech, he's on the soundstage, and Goldwyn invites her to come and watch, and it's, you know, in a dark. Everything is dark except for the lights focusing on Cooper, and people hear her crying in the background, and she leaves because she knows, you know, that kind of noise will get picked up. And but there's every reason to believe she loved the scene. It was not necessarily an impersonation, but it was a great suggestion of what was available to watch of Gehrig on the newsreel. And you saw the tears, you saw the watery eyes, you see him wiping his face. You know, Cooper, like I said, Cooper can convey emotion with just the slightest movement of his eyes. And if you notice, there is a point, you have to watch very, very closely, but there is a quick cut where it's clear that, you know, Cooper is on field at Wrigley Field getting ready to make the speech, then there's a cut that makes it very clear he's, to me, that he's in the soundstage because the backdrop goes from the real players in behind him to the newsreel.
And so for those from our generation, Wrigley Field was the site of the old Home Run Derby that was on TV. That Wrigley Field.
It was, and the first home of the Los Angeles Angels.
Yeah, that's right. First home of the LA Angels.
But you know, the funny thing about Home Run Derby is it was played in after the season in front of an empty stadium.
That's right.
You know, they didn't even think of bringing people in. I mean, yeah, it was the fall in L.A., but yeah, the players were in there in their uniforms. It was an empty place, but it was so wonderfully hokey. And it was, you know, Wrigley Field was a place, a go-to stadium for a lot of sitcoms. So, you know, it was a pretty popular stadium in its time. It no longer exists, but there it is.
When Gary goes overseas during World War II, a soldier shocked him with a request, and it turned out to be something that in subsequent appearances overseas he stuck with, and that request was the speech.
Well, yeah, Cooper had gone on a USO tour where he was basically just doing a comedy act, you know, some old Jack Benny sketches with a couple of actresses and an accordionist. And one day in Port Moresby in the South Pacific, one soldier shouts out something like, "Hey, Coop, how about the speech from the Gehrig film?" And, you know, he's not sitting around, you know, an actor doesn't necessarily keep all his lines in his head from previous films. He'd gone on to, he must have made at least two films since then. This is the fall of 43, so it's more than a year and a half since the movie came out. And he says, "Well, give me a few minutes. I got to go into my tent." And it's raining. It's I think it's monsoonal season in the South Pacific. And he says, "I got to write it down." So he wrote down what he can remember, and he delivered it. And it was the stunned silence of most likely thousands of soldiers, many of whom probably thought, "Well, I may not survive," and you know they must have identified in some way with Gehrig, who died before his time of a tragic disease that nobody could understand at that time. So, in each of the stops that Cooper made throughout the tour, ending in Sydney, Australia, he delivered the speech, and there was, at least according to him, there aren't too many accounts of this. At least according to him, there was a similarly respectful reaction to it, because he assumed, and maybe it's more than assumption, that they had seen the movie on the base or wherever they were stationed, and they understood it. And you know, if you recall in the book, Damon Runyon wrote an introduction to the film, that was a scroll after the credits, that very short, but it placed Gehrig in sort of the pantheon of soldiers who had lost their lives on the battlefields. And America was, in July of 42 when the movie came out, America was just eight months into its involvement. So I think the soldiers felt some sort of kinship with him, and Cooper unexpectedly was able to do something that he never did with another movie. You know, how many times does an actor get to deliver memorable lines from a movie that people had seen a year and a half ago, or had been released a year and a half before?
And it turned out Gary Cooper himself had cancer, and I want to say it was January of 61, I want to say, Richard.
Yeah.
He delivers his final public appearance at the Friars Club in Los Angeles, and he was renowned for the running joke on him. The stereotype was Gary Cooper, his best line was, "Yep." And so he was asked to obviously say a few words because it was a tribute to him, and he links Gary to himself.
Yeah, you know, it's like all of old Hollywood, which wasn't quite old Hollywood then, but Jack Benny, George Burns, Greer Garson, Audrey Hepburn, they're all there, and they all, it's sort of a gentle roast, except for Milton Berle. Milton Berle was out of his mind that day. And for some reason, Carl Sandburg was there making fun of Gary Cooper. So, Cooper, you know, he had bone cancer, and the cancer traveled to his bones, and he was in some pain. He still looked good. And this would be his last public appearance. At this point, his family had not told him he was terminal, which, as his daughter told me, is the basic personal parallel between he and Gehrig, whose wife didn't tell him exactly how dire it was early on. And And so he goes to the hotel, and it's a big ballroom. It's packed. It's a charitable, it's a fundraiser. And Billy Wilder, his friend, had written the speech with him, and he actually carried the speech up to the, up to the podium, as opposed to Garrick, who carried no speech at all with him. And it's very humble. It's very thankful. And at the very end, he said, "Well, if anybody thinks I'm the luckiest man in the world, I say yep." And that's the last thing he ever said publicly. And, you know, shortly, 4 months later, he was dead.
This was a fascinating book. I have many more things I could talk to you about with it, but there's only a limited amount of time. Richard, thank you so much for your time and also for putting together a really, really outstanding book. It's a great read this summer.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time and your praise.
Richard Sandomir wrote the book, The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. Yeah, of course, Richard Sandomir for years with the New York Times. We will come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Time now for our sports bozo of the day. Always intriguing. Many, many nominations. And this one deals with Novak Djokovic. Thursday brushed off comments from John McEnroe about Djokovic's personal life and a comparison to Tiger Woods. While speaking during the BBC's Wimbledon coverage, McEnroe drew a comparison to Woods by discussing the struggles of Djokovic, who has not won a Grand Slam since simultaneously holding all four titles following last year's French Open. He has had some off-the-court issues with the family, and that's going to throw you. The person that comes to mind immediately with Novak is not a tennis player. It's actually Tiger Woods. So on Thursday, Djokovic was asked about McEnroe's comparison. He says, "Yeah, I heard about it today." I said, "Well, look, you know, John has a complete right to say, anybody really in the world has a right to say what they want. I respect that, especially coming from John, because he's someone that has earned the right because of who he is and what he has meant to the sport and what he is still representing as a former player and still very active on the tour. He's well known for bold comments and not really caring too much about being politically correct, but saying whatever's on your mind. That's all I can say. I don't really take anything personal." Djokovic married his wife, Yelena, in 2014. They have a son, Stefan, who will turn three. The couple's expecting their second child later this year. While his struggles on the court are clear for everyone to see, Djokovic wasn't sure why McEnroe would compare his off-the-court issues to that of Tiger Woods, who, of course, we all know what happened with him. He said, "I don't know what the basis is for that. I'm really not sure. When I was warming up for my first match today, he was giving an intro, talking on camera, and I served, and the serve went right at him as I was playing. I don't know. Maybe just because of that. I don't know. I was just joking." But I don't know of any off-the-court issues at all. He's married, been married now for 3 years. They have a son, and they're expecting their second son later this year. I don't know. Now, since winning the French Open, he lost in the third round at Wimbledon last summer. He suffered a first-round exit at the Rio Olympics. Stan Wawrinka beat him in the U.S. Open final. And then in the Australian Open second round, he lost. And then in the French Open, he got knocked out. Okay. The number one for 122 straight weeks, no longer number one. It could be part complacency. It could be part, but But I don't think there's any suggestion anywhere that he's got some sort of off-the-court family wife issue. So that earns our spot as the sports bozo of the day. Pirates and Phillies coming up. Airtime about 50 minutes from now on the show. So 50 minutes from now, airtime. It's a 6 o'clock start time. It's an early start in the fourth and final game of this series that is coming up. And the Phillies won the first game. Pirates won the last two. I mentioned earlier, how about John Gray of the Colorado Rockies? The pitcher hitting a 467-foot home run. Okay. That is the story in sports today. College basketball, it's a big month for evaluations. By the way, also, I'll tell you right now, here's a name. I want you to just mark this down. This is the free agency time of the NBA. Let me give you the name of a key free agent that's going to help some team, and he will. Mike Muscala. Evaluation period for high school basketball this month. The evaluation periods will be July 12th to the 16th, the 19th to the 23rd, and the 26th to the 30th. So that's what that's coming up with, all right? And get a chance to go to Williamsport. I don't know how long he's going to stay there. I mean, who knows? He could be there, obviously, all year, the rest of the summer, I mean. But Adam Haseley's a good-looking prospect. I think Philly fans will be really an interesting guy for them to watch. Very interesting guy. Let's see. Also, let's see here. NASCAR champion Tony Stewart returns to racing this weekend. He'll be back in sprint cars for an event in Wisconsin and Iowa. He's always, like, running in those different events. Now, of course, we know that there was trouble with one in upstate New York a period of time ago, but he's always liked running in those events.
And there has been a time or two that he has made an appearance at Sewell's Grove Speedway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just, here I am. Well, okay. So,
get me behind the wheel, ready to drive.
Right, exactly.
Still has the itch to scratch.
Oh, boy. Sports Illustrated wrote this piece about the Braves fan who wanted the K signs in baseball eliminated. All right? And really disappointed with the sign at the new Braves Stadium. Definitely not okay. And what happened was, is Jaime Garcia had struck out three batters. And, of course, they put it up, and, of course, they're putting the K signs down, and what does it come out as after three strikeouts? And they're all swinging. KKK. Like, okay. It received a lot of Twitter reaction, and all the Twitter reaction was, like, what are you talking about? Okay. And then somebody said, well, to make it feel, if it makes you feel better, he just struck out his fourth batter. So, oh, my goodness. Crazy. Rafa Nadal today, signing, ended up, by request, signing a prosthetic leg for a fan at Wimbledon today. So a couple of other notes along the way. You know, what's interesting is that, and I've talked about social media before, everyone knows that while I would have the ability to be a social media king, I am not. Stop laughing.
No, you do have the power to make that happen.
No. You know what? You know what I find with social media? It, you know, obviously there are a lot of good things to it. You know, people get their opinions out, or they get a message out, or whatever they can. I mean, even in news, I mean, you can sit there with a tweet, you can at least get a headline out, and it's instantaneous. Those are all pluses with it. But it sure is hard to communicate in 140 characters in black and white. It really is difficult. I've talked about that before. It's just not my bag. I've got so many other things going on. What kind of time do I have to tweet? As soon as I'm done with this show, what am I going to do? Tweet? Or am I going to drive? I'm going to drive out to Williamsport. I got a game tonight. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's what it comes down to. It comes down to, A, I don't want to do it. And I don't really have what you'd call tons of time to do it. I mean, tomorrow, for example, I've got some TV work in the morning. I've got something at 1 o'clock. I got this show at 3 o'clock. And then I've got to MC an event at Beaver Stadium tomorrow night. Then I got a ball game. And I'll be done about, I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock tomorrow night. Now, exactly what part is there for me to tweet? Plus, I'm on this show. You hear all my rambling opinions all the time anyway. No, that's right. I just remembered. I forgot. I got to vote for the old Big Ten team tomorrow. So what do I have to vote for here? I have to vote for, huh? Johnny Holiday gets the vote, too.
Now, this be preseason football?
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. What do I have to vote for? 10-person preseason honors list, 5 from each division. There you go. Let's see who's on this voting thing. There aren't many of us. Wow. Interesting list.
So they've given you the list. You just pick 5 off that list. It could be...
Yeah, but I could write in anybody I want.
Right. So it could be 5 on the same team, but obviously it won't happen.
It's not going to be that way, but,
sure.
But it's going to be each division. You can only be 5 each division. One year, I did write in one. I've only written in one ever. Only one time did I ever write in the preseason. You know who that was? Russell Wilson. I think I was right. He just transferred from NC State to Wisconsin. I remember Ron Vanderlinden and I were driving to Scranton, and Ron and I were going to speak to the Greater Scranton Club that particular year. And he asked me who I voted for, so I told him. And he looked at me, he says, Russell Wilson? I said, yeah, at Wisconsin. He says, really? And I had known his stats, and I said, geez, Ron, I said, name another quarterback that has 103 career touchdown passes in this league. He says, no, that's a good point. I mean, he had 103 career touchdown passes before he even played a game in the Big Ten. And he had an incredible year here, Monte Ball. I mean, Penn State's going into, this is going to be Penn State's 25th football season in the Big Ten. You realize that? 25th football season in the Big Ten. So if you're between 30 and 35, you probably don't remember much of anything about Penn State not playing a Big Ten game. Maybe a game or two, maybe you're like 7 or 8. But if you're between 30 and 35... So, like, between the ages of 5 and 10, when Penn State entered the Big Ten. Think about that. That's how long they've been in the conference. 25 years. To be the 25th season of Big Ten football. And overall, Penn State's 131st or something like that? Something like that. So, 106 seasons as an independent, now 25th season of the Big Ten. It's been one of those roller coaster rides at times And I don't mean roller coaster ride in terms of record. I mean sometimes roller coaster ride in terms of treatment, recognition. It's one of the issues that the Big Ten has when it comes to Penn State, is that the entry into the conference is always going to be one that was a sticky one. Nebraska came in, it was 11-0 vote. Wisconsin and Rutgers come in, they were each 12-0 votes. Penn State came in, it was 7-3. And Minnesota, which was the most vehement against, Michigan and Indiana voted no. And they needed one more vote to get to 7. And Northwestern was that last vote. And Northwestern had to be convinced that they were not being kicked out of the conference in favor of Penn State. When they were told, like, no, 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 we are solidly, no question about it, going with 11 schools, Northwestern voted yes. Ironically, Penn State then had to survive a vote to stay in the Atlantic 10 one more year just for the basketball and the other sports. And they needed 7 votes to kick Penn State out. They got the 6. And Rutgers voted to keep Penn State in. Temple voted to keep Penn State in. And West Virginia abstained. So they got to stay in one more year, and they won the men's and women's basketball tournaments that year to get to the NCAA. Then since then, of course, some of the officiating stuff, some of the scheduling stuff, there's been a few things along the way that have been tough and they've had to overcome. But in the end, the financial stability that the Big Ten has brought, you cannot put figuratively a price on. Got a lot more to talk about that down the road here. It's going to be an interesting month. It's also 5 years this month since the sanctions. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC Way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC Way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC Way. The SMC Way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Well, the Big Ten has evolved over time in the 25 years. 2 divisions, 14 schools now, instant replay, other things, all things that were advocated right here in the backyard. Joe Paterno advocated for all of that. We need instant replay, we got instant replay. Should have at least 12 schools that have 2 divisions in a championship game. He advocated for that. They finally did that. But it's the 25th season coming up. Certain things here that have happened, there have been so many exciting games. There's also been some things that have warped from the ridiculous into the sublime. The penalty against Penn State for excessive crowd noise. Are you kidding me? I mean, I'm sitting there like, you called what? What? I never heard of that in my life. That was in 1993 against Michigan. Everybody's looking at each other like, what the heck are you talking about? Welcome to the East, dog. this isn't you rolling at a par on 17. Hey, this is a big game. Crazy. And they messed around with the Leaders and Legends thing for a little bit, you know, which was done, by the way, out of research. There was a reason why they did it. They were trying to get depth in each division. And they put a lot of research. Mark Rudner and his staff put a lot of research into that. And, of course, everybody got hung up on the names and typical. They called it Legends and Leaders, so people got hung up on the name. Like, look at the hand, look at the hand, look at the hand. Okay, now let's just take one moment and look at the substance of... No. The hand's more interesting. Leaders, Legends, it's stupid. Why did you call that? Here's the hand. You wonder why people in the know sometimes shake their head. Like, what? You're upset about what? The name of the division? Hand. Look at the hand. Look at the hand. It's so easy for a group of people to constantly take their eye off the ball.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury. You can hear us anywhere in the world with the Sunbury Broadcasting Corporation app.